Hi, welcome to BCI Cattle Chat. I'm Brad White. Happy to have you with us listening today and happy to have these guys here in the studio. Morning, Brian.
Morning, Brad.
Morning, Philip.
Good morning, Brad.
Morning, Bob.
Good morning, guys.
And we've got Craig Payne with us from the University of Missouri. Good morning, Craig.
Good morning.
So Craig is the University Extension Veterinarian in Missouri, and he's kind enough to join us this morning. And we've got some good information that we're going to share. We're going to talk some about a variety of topics, including some new antibiotic legislation that's coming, as well as how to manage those first calf heifers before they've calved. And then we're going to touch on hairy heel warts, because that's another emerging disease issue that we want to talk a little bit about. Craig, it's good to have you with us. I know you've been you spent some time in private practice, and then you've been at the University of Missouri for a while. Tell us a little bit about you.
Right. So I'm a Missouri native, grew up in Sedalia. That's where I practiced at for about 11 to 12 years. And then went off to the King Ranch Institute for Ranch Management in 2005, and came back to University of Missouri in 2007. And I actually hold the position that Dr. Larson held at the University.
We just passed the baton over to Craig.
But it's good to be here.
Excellent. Well, we're happy to have you with us. And before we get into our topics, as you talked about Dr. Larson coming here, you know, as you go through life, sometimes there are changes, and then sometimes you have to do things to keep it interesting and keep it fun. And because we don't have video with the podcast, you can't ever see that on Fridays, Dr. Larson has started a new tradition. So it is Hawaiian Shirt Friday. So when he comes into work on Friday, he's got a loud Hawaiian shirt on.
Yes. And my wife, I think she kind of resisted it for a while, but she just gives up. And now she's actually pretty good at finding me some pretty fun Hawaiian shirts. I kind of started it in COVID because I thought people were just too serious, too bummed out. So I said, I'm an old dude. I can just show up in a Hawaiian shirt and see if we can liven things up a bit.
So Brian and Philip, I got to ask you guys, he's gone to Hawaiian shirts on Fridays. What's going to be your thing to keep it lively?
Can we do no pants Friday?
No. No, that is not allowed.
I don't have, no, sorry. I'm not a trendsetter.
So we'll have to ask.
So I've got a suggestion for Brian.
Well, I was going to ask for suggestions from the listeners.
Maybe.
They can send in suggestions for how Brian can liven it up on Fridays.
Give me a couple minutes. I'll think of my own things.
Well, if you don't have anything by the end of the episode, then you'll have to take listener suggestions or worse, Bob's suggestions. Yeah, exactly. So, Craig, do you have anything to liven it up?
Not a trendsetter either, so I'm open for suggestions.
All right. So if you have any suggestions for Brian to liven it up or a good – and Bob's already got Hawaiian shirts with cows and bulls, so – you have anything for him, you can certainly send us an email at bci@ksu.edu, and I will pass it along to those guys. So on a more serious topic, want to talk a little bit about, and Craig, one of your jobs as Extension is you work a lot with producers in the state. Missouri is a lot cow-calf state, heavily cow-calf state. There are a lot of different things on the horizon. One of the things that you mentioned as we were visiting earlier was talking about some of the new legislation. So the GFI 263, which is actually legislation that came from the FDA, that's going to go into effect a year from now. So 2023 in June-ish, somewhere in there. Tell us a little bit about what's coming with that, and we'll get feedback from Brian as well.
Sure. So FDA's looked at moving all our medically important antimicrobials from over-the-counter availability to requiring veterinary oversight. Really, one of the first actions was with the Veterinary Feed Directive, which went into effect in 2017, or at least it moved at that point in time. A lot of those feed-grade antimicrobials went from OTC to requiring a VFD. My understanding is, and Brian can elaborate on this, is that impacted about 95% of the antimicrobials that we use in the livestock industry, or at least medically important. And so what this GFI 263 is doing is looking at that remaining 5%, and within that 5% is like your injectable oxytetracycline, penicillin. So those products are targeted to be moved from OTC to prescription status by June of next year.
Well, you talk about percents, and Brian, I'll ask you to clarify, but when you talk about percents in that case, it's percents based on volumes of products, not necessarily individual doses for treatment.
Yeah, those numbers are based on like a milligram sold basis. And so when you talk about the percents, it's a little bit elevated because feed grade accounts for such a large use, right? And so certainly there will be individual producers. If you're a producer that doesn't use feed grade antibiotics, You have a small herd and you're used to walking into a farm and feed store and picking up a bottle of injectable oxytetracycline or penicillin or some sulfa tablets without a prescription, that's going to change. So that's the person that'll be impacted the most. And just to, I guess, to be technically correct, it's not legislation the way we think of laws. The way this process will work is the FDA is working with drug manufacturers to actually change the labels. So the label will change from an over-the-counter to a prescription. And the big part of that change will just be when it's a prescription product, it requires a veterinary client-patient relationship.
Yeah, good clarification. So it's a change in the label, and then the process will be the same as our other prescription projects process, which you described, that requires the veterinary client-patient relationship. So, Bob, what is that veterinary client-patient relationship?
Well, basically, it's kind of a definition of what it takes to assure all those involved, so that is veterinarians, beef cattle producers, as well as consumers, that when we use antimicrobials, antibiotics, those types of products, that a veterinarian knows about the operation, so they know, you know, how many cattle do they have, you know, not necessarily down to the head, but, you know, they know attributes of the operation, they know the producer personally, and they are involved enough in the decision making of drug use within that operation that they take responsibility for, you know, writing these prescriptions or VFDs. And so basically a veterinary client patient relationship just is a way to say, yeah, the veterinarian knows this producer, they know the client and the animals that are on their operation, and because of that interaction, they can provide good guidance on use of these products.
So Brian, you teach pharmacology. Did he get it right? Is that the right definition?
Yeah, that's pretty close.
Okay,
yeah.
Pretty close.
Pretty close.
Yeah. Sounded like a B. Yeah.
I'm going for pretty close.
Okay. Yeah, but it's that relationship which I think drives it. So this legislation, while it may seem like it's a big change, the process is already in place on the prescription side, which is where we use a lot of the drugs for treatments. It's just going to be shifting how you get them. So you do want to be sure you have a veterinary client-patient relationship similar to VFDs.
Yeah, and this is something that's really been changing over my entire career. When I very first started in veterinary medicine, there basically were no prescription products available. And that changed fairly early in my career. With just a couple of new products that came along that had required basically a veterinarian to talk to a producer before the decision was made whether this was a good choice or not. And then over time, partly because of some of the new products that came on board and changing societal pressures and things like that, we've really had prescription products for many of the new since the 80s,
yeah.
Have been prescription all along. And we're down to just a few that aren't prescription. So in some ways, this isn't a big change. In other ways, it is kind of a big change.
So I think it'll be interesting to see. And that plays out over the next year. So we just wanted to give you a heads up on that at this point. One of the other topics that we wanted to talk about, and we've talked a lot about being sure that our replacement heifers are ready at the start of the calving season, making sure they're able to have those calves. And now we may be on some operations between they had their first calf and breeding, or we're right at the time of breeding for those replacement heifers. So Philip, I'm going to start with you. What are some of the big things that I need to be looking out for on and I'm going to define replacement heifer as she had a calf this spring and now I want her to rebreed. So it's really a first calf heifer.
So kind of depends on where she's at on some things to think about. The biggest thing we need to be concerned about is her body condition at this point. And if you're already at the start of the breeding season, it's too late to do much about it because you can't put body condition back on her and get her to start cycling fast enough within your normal breeding season. If you're not there, depending on how far away you are, look at where they're at in body condition score. Hopefully they're five and a half. If they're below that, need to work with a nutritionist, your veterinarian, somebody that can help you design a supplement and work to get those heifers back into good body condition.
Yeah, I do think it's important to kind of consider that this is a subset of the herd that's a little bit different than older cows. You know, some of the things we think about these, they're still not quite mature size, so they're still diverting some of their calories and protein to their own growth, and so they're more likely to be a little bit thin. I teach the students that they have a longer period of infertility following calving than a mature cow. There's a few people that will argue with me that say that they can have these heifers after their first calf have just as as short a period of infertility as a mature cow. But usually what they mean by that is they manage them separately. They pull them away from the mature cows. They maybe provide them with a diet that's a little more calorie dense, you know, and, you know, or put them on, you know, they lead graze them, or those types of things to make sure that they can keep up with the cows. So they are a subset. And I think most people would say they're probably the hardest group to get bred on a cow-calf operation.
Well, yeah. Looking at the data that you collected last year with Dr. Hoosier on his project, those first calf heifers are the hardest to get bred back at a normal rate. So, Craig, you have any tips or ideas or things you think about when you're managing those first calf heifers?
Well, I don't know how much ground you can gain if you're behind at the breeding season, and that's a challenge. And so that was going to kind of be a thought that I was going to pose to Bob or others, is when you are behind the eight ball and it's breeding season, how's the best way to get caught up? Is it if you're in an artificial insemination program, does Cedars help jumpstart some of those heifers that may not be cycling?
So the controlled internal drug release or a progesterone addition.
My answer to that is a little bit, but I'm going to stick with what Philip and you both said. If you're behind at the start of the breeding season, any of the, you know, that you can try a short-term weaning, you can try a cedar, a progesterone, and you might move a few animals a little bit earlier, but it's been unrewarding to me. And those take a fair amount of work and money, and I make a small amount of progress, in my opinion. So I think it's, and maybe this conversation is best said of, if you're kind of behind this year, your best solution is in a year from now, or actually in 9 months from now, really address this at that time, that this is a little bit late.
So you're saying cut your losses and move on?
Meaning that you might have more open first calf heifers than you like, and that's the hand you're dealt. I'm not sure I would. I don't think you can really fix that, and I don't necessarily like to keep late bred cows, even if it's a young cow.
So if you're behind now on the body score, you're gonna have trouble catching
up. And you know, I still think, you know, don't let them lose additional weight. So they may need to be separated out. They may, because I don't want to lose a pregnancy or those types of things, you know, early as we're dropping body weight. But yeah, that the real intervention was probably 3 months ago.
Yeah, and I was going to say that those first calf heifers, if they get bred later, they don't get bred now, they're the hardest ones to rebreed. But that is the biggest determinant of how long that cow is going to stay in the herd, is if she can get rebred right now. And if you got some heifers that can get rebred at less than optimum body condition score, you got some pretty good cows. And so, but then back to what Bob said was about their nutrition going forward, that once we get past kind of 6-7 months and you're about ready to wean that calf, or you have weaned that calf here this fall, that's the time to make sure you're treating those heifers kind of extra special and make sure that they are in a really good body condition score come calving next year, so that they can have the shortest postpartum interval as possible and stay in that herd.
Yeah, that becomes the challenge. And one of the things you mentioned, Bob, was segregation. So I guess I'd ask, and all three of you, what are the segregation timelines? So how long do I have to keep them separate? Would you separate them after calving? Would you separate them for the whole summer?
Well, it does depend on the situation. Most of the time when we're talking about segregation, it's prior to this time. It's prior to grass turnout. You know, so it would be over the winter to really get them into the right body condition headed into calving. It might be the early part of the grazing season, those types of things, just to make sure that they get off to a good start. They're a separate group from a number of standpoints. This is a group where we're most likely to have some calving difficulties. And so there's a lot of ranches that just kind of that first pregnancy, so their first calving, and so leading up to the first calving, closer observation during the calving season, and then some extra attention to their body condition score as we approach grass turnout. It is true that once we get to grass turnout, we're probably going to turn them in with cows. But again, if I'm behind, I may do it differently this year and just try to do everything I can, you know, like I said, lead graze them or do something like that so that they have the very best potential to stay in the herd.
But it's almost too late.
It's almost too late.
So. I mean, and that's kind of the point of this discussion, is there are times when you need to make a distinction between, should I try to do something, is there a cost benefit, or is it too late?
I don't like to give Bob credit for much, but I will give him credit for this, and that is, you know, he did a presentation several years ago at a veterinary meeting where he talked about heifer development kind of as keeping your foot on the pedal and not pulling it off, and I think that's the whole gist of this conversation is that you got to keep that momentum building in heifer development. Otherwise, you stubbed your toe in a situation like this. There's not much you can do to correct it in a short period of time.
Yeah, it's too late. But then you start thinking about next year, right? So next year's heifers are usually – next year's first calf heifers are usually right there with breeding group getting bred for the first time. And then the next year's crop just hit the ground, right? So you think about, you've got 3 years there. So if I see I've got a real problem in my heifers that just calved, I should turn my head a little and look to the heifers that are just getting ready to breed. Because part of this equation, and I'm with you, Bob, on the they have a longer postpartum interval or period of time after calving before they're ready to breed, which means if I want them to breed back at the start of the breeding season, they need to calve a little earlier before the cows, if possible. So I think those are great considerations as you think through that heifer process. One of the other topics we want to talk about, Brian, you've actually done, well, at least some field studies on this and a little bit of research. A question that comes up is relative to hairy heel warts. Now, we'll see this on different operations. It was, I think, first reported in dairy cattle. It's been reported some in feedlots. I haven't heard a lot about it on the cow-calf side, but I wanted to start with you and say, first off, what are hairy heel warts?
So hairy heel wart has a couple different names. So the technical term for it is papillomatous digital dermatitis, or people refer to it as PDD. And then hairy heel warts, kind of one of the common names, are strawberry foot rot. So you'll hear all those. So we're talking, all of those are the same disease process. And you're right, it's kind of pretty, actually fairly predominant in the dairy industry. So I saw it clinically in practice, and then saw a few cases here when I came back to the university. One was in a feed yard, and now they're more commonly reported in the feed yards. So, but it's a foot rot like, so it's a disease of the foot. It causes these, I'll use the term and then I'll explain, it's a proliferative lesion. So when you talk about regular foot rot, that's a bacterial infection between the toes, and it kind of destroys the tissue. This disease, we think it's a bacterial infection. There's probably something else that contributes, and we don't know what that is, to lead to one cow getting it and one not. But the proliferative lesion is kind of a growth. So if you think that, and that's the strawberry foot rot term, is really, if you want a mental description of it, that's what it, if you would imagine somebody cutting a strawberry in half and gluing it to the back of a foot, that's a lot of times what you see. The other kind of presentation, the other way we see this disease, is the hairy heel wart part. And so we don't see that strawberry part, but we see these, the hairs on the back of the foot tend to stick together, and it has this kind of, it looks like an overgrowth of abnormal hairs there is what it looks like.
So hairy warts and strawberries on the back of the foot. Thanks for making this appetizing.
Yep, no problem.
So, Brian, you mentioned you see it a lot in dairies. Where I'm familiar with it is in feedlot cattle that are being finished in confinement barns or deep pack barns and that kind of stuff. So what are the conditions that really lead to this issue?
Yeah, so we don't know. That's the thing. So it's been associated with a bacteria-like organism called a treponeme. That's probably part of it, but it's not all of it. We can't experimentally reproduce the disease by just putting treponemes on the foot. So there's probably something that has to do with damage to the skin surface or anaerobic conditions. So like having mud packed on the foot or things like that, that lead to this kind of perfect storm of factors that then lead to a case of foot rot.
Yeah, we have seen it a couple of times in a cow-calf situation in, like, again, dry lot situation when you're developing bulls, like a group of young bulls or something like that. So kind of it seems in my experience too that it's a little bit more confinement type of a situation. I've heard of it kind of after you've turned some cattle out on pasture and it persists for a while, but I've heard it mostly developed in a dry lot type situation. Is that fair to say, or am I oversimplifying?
Confinement, sure. Dry lot, I mean, we'd see it in dairy herds that are concrete. They're concrete. So, you know, yeah. But it seems to be more prevalent in confined systems, yeah.
So it's not just the mud. Sometimes with foot rot, we think of mud or muddy pastures or areas, and that's, as you said, between the digits on the toe. I'm just wondering how the heck I would see this, because I don't spend maybe as much time as I should looking at the back of the feet of the cattle, so I'm not sure that I would visually I don't go out and inspect their feet and see a lesion. Is that how I would find this, or what's the clinical presentation?
Well, you're going to see lameness, first of all, and you know, if you're doing due diligence, then you're going to inspect the foot, and in the midst of that process, you'll find that characteristic.
So they'll be pretty lame from this, yeah. Or kind of lame, or a lot lame.
It's kind of been my experience that they get fairly lame from it.
They're generally pretty lame, and it is extremely painful to touch, pressure. So when we were in dairy practice, one of the things that we would tell clients, so producers were doing the diagnostics, and in a dairy parlor where we have water, right? And so if you spray a lesion, like you spray the foot and they have a hairy heel wart lesion, is extremely painful to even that kind of pressure. So, you know, things that make it different from foot rot, usually with foot rot, you'll see swelling above the hoof. Typically, you won't see that with hairy heel wart, although you can. That big strawberry type lesion, that's a definite, that's what it is. Like Craig said, you have to pick up the foot at some point. If you're treating foot rot cases and they're not responding, that would be a reason to bring them in and pick up the foot and look. There are some further diagnostics you can do. You can do biopsies and things like that if you need to. And sometimes you do that in a first case. If you've never seen it, you know, something's just not right, that's good. If you or your veterinarian are doing that, make sure that you put hairy heel wart on your list, because it's not the routine testing. There's some additional tests you have to do to find it.
So if I find it, how do I treat it?
Yeah, so treatment, we, like you said, we had a case here that was in a feed yard, and we tried some injectable therapies, and just anecdotally, I'd say they didn't work well. The treatment that's been used in the dairy industry and some feed yards that have serious issues with this, there's foot baths if you're managing a large number of animals, and foot baths have a lot of logistical challenges. Managing them is a mess for a large number of animals because they get dirty very quickly, and the things you put in them are inactivated by sort of any sort of organic material, so mud, manure. So you have to change the foot bath often. You have to run animals through an alley, make sure they put all their feet in it. The products you use in the foot bath, they're typically either antimicrobials or disinfectants, or heavy metals. So things like copper sulfate have been used, formalin have been used. The problem with copper sulfate is it gets out in the environment, so we have copper contamination. Formalin actually breaks down quite nice in the environment, but there's a worker safety hazard, right? It's a known carcinogen. So there aren't great solutions. If it's a small number of animals, topical application of an antibiotic with either a garden type sprayer or bandaging over the foot, those things can be managed, you know, one or two cases. But typically what we see is it starts with one or two cases, and then you kind of experience a herd issue.
So you've got to work with your veterinarian to come up with the plan that suits your operation. Kind of like we talked earlier, that veterinary client patient relationship, you've got to have that in place.
Yeah. All of those are extra label drug uses. So you have to have a veterinarian involved in that.
So if you see that, or you think you see that, certainly reach out to your veterinarian. And this has been a great discussion. And Craig, we're glad that you could join us today and share some information. So happy to have you with us, and happy to have you with us listening as well. As always, we enjoy listener questions, so you can send us an email if you want at bci@ksu.edu. And don't forget to wear your Hawaiian shirt on Friday.
I'll be there.
Or whatever else they suggest.
Or whatever they suggest for Brian.